Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. In about 30 minutes, middle of the last hour, we'll discuss the theology of PETA with David Martosko. In the meantime, we're talking about Newsweek's cover story, Spirituality in America. Ken Samples is our guest. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for August deals with an aspect of spirituality in America that did not get addressed in the Newsweek magazine cover story. In fact, one might even call it a religion that didn't get mentioned there. Had they included it, I think it would have confused things a little bit, even more confused than they already are. American civil religion. Is the God of American civil religion, does that God bear any resemblance to the God of biblical Christianity? The answer is no. So why can't so many Christians tell the difference? If you're a good American, does that mean you'll be a Christian? If you're a good Christian, does that mean you're an American? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for August is called The Anonymous God: The Church Confronts American Civil Religion and Society. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the book on our homepage. It's $16.99 plus shipping and handling. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for The Anonymous God, The Issues Etc. book of the month for August. Ken, back to the subject of the Newsweek story here. I found in one of the bylines, or one of the sidebar stories, a dictionary of the divine, and there's branches of Christianity in there, everything from fundamentalism to Pentecostalism, from Sufism to Wicca, from Zen to paganism. How important is it that Christians today, living in this spiritual America, know the landscape, at least the basics of the landscape?
I think it's critically important. I mean, when you look to the New Testament, how important is belief? Well, it's incredibly important. To be a Christian, you have to believe the truth about God, the truth of what God says about our sinfulness, the truth of what God says about his son, Jesus Christ. And I think it is necessary to be able to have some facility to evaluate where these particular religions are going and what they believe. And again, I think some type of classification of knowing what these religious groups believe about God and about salvation or redemption, about humanity, I think it's critically important. And of course, from a biblical standpoint as well, we're told that one of the ever-existing components in the world will be a matter of deception. And so I think doctrinal discernment is critically important now as it ever has been in the past.
Lisa Miller rightly observed that Pentecostalism is the fastest growing form of Christianity, if not spirituality in general in the U.S. But she also observed about Pentecostalism in a different answer to a different question, that the whole issue of what you believe is not considered highly relevant in Pentecostalism. You could say, well, you know, I'm a Roman Catholic, according to what I believe, but I'm also a Pentecostal, or I'm also a Pentecostal. What does that indicate to you?
Well, I think this smorgasbord type of approach is very appealing to lots of people. I think people have kind of turned away from a theological system in which doctrines are seen to be to comport with each other and to be a unified part of Christian theology. I think lots of people like it that they can try a little bit of fruit on this side of the religious tree and then move to another tree and try something else. Of course, the problem is that often, you know, this is an incoherent system, and often these people don't realize that their theology really conflicts. And God's Word does not conflict. The Bible presents us Christian theology as a unified whole. The Trinity, the Atonement, the deity of Christ, all of these doctrines go together in a coherent system. I'm not sure that's possible when you begin to trade practices and religious ideas so freely.
Is part of the problem, part of the root cause of that smorgasbord approach to spirituality, especially on the part of Christians, is that Christians don't know or believe what Christianity teaches?
I think that's just so important, Todd. Yaroslav Pelikan, who years ago was a distinguished Lutheran, he said, you know, the church is always more than a school. And certainly it is. It's a place we go to worship. It's a place we go to receive the Lord's Supper. It's a place where we go for many reasons. But Pelikan said it should never be less than a school. And it seems to me that a very important component in any of our churches should be instructing people in basic scriptural doctrine and informing people as to why we believe the creeds, why we believe Jesus is God, why we believe in the Trinity. I think that's the culprit. I think that our churches apparently have not done a very good job in this score. And it encourages me. I worked with Walter Martin at the Christian Research Institute. I saw how difficult it was, Todd, to bring people out of cultic groups. I made up my mind later in my own ministry that the way I would combat it is teaching Christians good doctrine so they would never get into the cults to begin with.
So preventative measures.
Right.
Well, I note in reading this Newsweek article that with the possible exception of the young people described at this very Orthodox Roman Catholic college and their devotion, they seem to be not only into the rite and ritual of Roman Catholicism, but also into the teachings of the church, reviving some teachings that were kind of considered defunct along with the piety. With that exception, many of the most popular movements, spiritual movements in the U.S. are patently doctrinal. That is, doctrine is not a big deal. It's not pursued in a serious way.
Yeah, and that of course, runs so counter to the New Testament. I mean, in the New Testament, Jesus says, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. You know, John says very explicitly, those who have Christ, you know, have salvation, and those who don't, the wrath of God rests upon them. It really does seem that we have reached a point where doctrinal truth, the idea of it's important for me to know specifically what I believe, has really reached a low ebb. And because of that, I think that deception or the opportunity for deception has reached a high peak.
Is it? I don't know how closely you looked at the data presented in the Newsweek article, but is there also a racial component, not a racist component, but a racial component at work here, at least, or an ethnic component in the diversity that we're seeing in American spirituality?
Well, it certainly does seem that, you know, particular groups are attracted to particular movements, whether it would be inner-city blacks, whether it would be Hispanics, whether it would be people who are immigrants to the United States. It does seem that certain people are predisposed toward particular religious involvement. And it seems to me that in one way or another, you know, all of us in some way or another have our worldview kind of given to us. We kind of adopt what we're given, and then we kind of go through our own exploration of these types of things. So I certainly think it's true that certain ethnic groups are predisposed toward certain religious ideas.
Almost 20% of those who said, almost 20% of those who say, I started out as one thing, then say, I changed to something else. I started out as a Christian, I changed to a Buddhist. In fact, there's a story here about a former Baptist who became now a Buddhist, and her story is told there. She's a professor of religion at Wesleyan University. Why does this happen? A conscious change from Christianity to something not only very different, but something that Christianity would consider patently false.
Yeah, this is I think this is very intriguing. Todd, I'm working right now on a book on worldviews, and one of the chapters I explore the question, where do we get our worldview? And for most of us, it is something that we adopt from our parents or from our, you know, early experiences. And then typically we go through an experience where we test and evaluate, and hopefully in a Christian perspective, that worldview that's held by our parents is then held to by us. It's not just our parents' faith, it's our faith. It's interesting that the article said that one out of five people switched religions as an adult. This, I think, is very intriguing. I wonder whether that early instruction that should come from a Christian point of view, I wonder in many cases whether that really is ever there. And I wonder how many people kind of give up believing in Christianity, but in reality they never really believed in historic Christianity. So these are challenging issues, and I think all the more it tells us in our churches what the pastor does, what our Sunday school teachers do, what parents do is really, really very important. That may be one of our most important callings in life, is teaching our children.
What did you make of the story? I just mentioned it a moment ago, but the story about Franciscan University and about the young people there who, in the words of the author or authors of that particular part of the article, are ultra-devout Catholics.
Yeah, this, of course, is interesting. I've been a student of Catholicism. In fact, I grew up in kind of a nominal Catholic family, and in college read C.S. Lewis and went to a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod college and earned my bachelor's degree. I think it's interesting that in some respects, people who kind of embrace spirituality would look at traditional Catholics as kind of, you know, ultra-devotional, when in reality they're just kind of traditional Roman Catholics in their affirmation. They're embracing what the Church believes, and from that standpoint, I think if you believe in Catholicism, you should embrace it. It is interesting, though, that I'm sure Lisa Miller would think that any kind of traditional embracing of the faith, either a Protestant, Catholic, or Orthodox, would in some ways be viewed as kind of ultra-traditional.
That's one of the things that I thought was interesting here. And that is, if you look at just the raw statistics, you've got the majority of Christians in the U.S. still claiming to be Roman Catholic. And then you've got, and they're, you know, quickly followed by the Baptists and others. If you look at the breakdown of states, most of the states are blue because most of the states are predominantly Roman Catholic. And yet that's taken on kind of a sociological flavor, whereas people who simply practice Catholicism, as Catholicism is designed to be practiced, and believe what it says, are considered ultra-devout.
Yeah.
I think I'd be considered ultra-devout as a Lutheran, based upon those some kind of definitions.
Definitely. They are coming up with, I think, different categories of analysis. What they would call ultra-devout, probably guys like you and I would say, you know, that's just the standard commitment that we have to believing what we believe to be true.
So is this why, say, Christians who continue to take seriously the doctrines of the Christian faith and have not given in to the general mashing down, flattening down of all things into this generic spirituality, still believe that the Bible is the inerrant word of God, still take seriously what the Bible teaches in all aspects, not only those pertaining to salvation, are considered, well, the other label is fundamentalist.
Absolutely. I mean, when I wrote about this question of tolerance, Todd, it seems to me that people who kind of want religion to be boiled down to the lowest common denominator, people in that mindset, they view anybody who believes that truth is real and that it is revealed and that it's knowable, that is narrow, that it is a fundamentalist mindset. But the interesting point, I think, is that often that kind of critique comes from people who either think there is no truth or that truth is unknowable. So any person who is tenacious about their beliefs and devotes themselves to living according to Christian values is seen as somebody who is less than tolerant and kind of in the fundamentalist mode.
So have we watched, and this is just my ham-fisted attempt at his historical analysis, have we watched in the 20th century Christianity boiled down to generic Christianity? Track it through the career of Billy Graham, where at the end, it's kind of, well, you know, it's all good kind of Christianity. Now we're in this next phase, which is all spirituality, embracing all religions, is getting mashed down to a generic spirituality.
I'm afraid so. You know, Alistair McGrath once said that it's very difficult for people on the outside to know what's going on in the inside. So non-Christians often misunderstand Christianity. I think it's probably true about even Christian groups. Protestants struggle to understand Catholicism. Catholics have difficulty understanding more biblically oriented Protestants. It seems that there is this kind of boiling down and kind of generic type of approach to these types of things. And it again, I think, echoes us back to the need to be able to explain people clearly and concisely the essence of the Christian faith, that it's about Christ, that it's not about me per se, that it's not essentially about ethics, it's about redemption, and ethics flow from redemption. So I think the antidote to all of this, Todd, is that we really need clear-minded Christians who are very good at communicating biblical truth.
What is it going to take for I'm thinking about my kids growing up the vast majority of their life in the 21st century in this kind of spiritualized America, growing up in a family where the Christian truths are still taught, but what is it going to take for them being Christians in that world they will grow up in? What do they need to know most?
Well, you know, my daughter is going away to college. She just graduated from high school this summer. And, you know, we sat down together, and I talked with her very clearly and very carefully. You know, you are going to be experiencing all kinds of ideas. You're going to be having professors who have all kinds of perspectives, and some of them will be antithetical. She's going to a public college. I think, Todd, that it brings us back to some fundamental basics. We really need to understand what historic Christianity is about. We need to be able to communicate that to the people in the pews. Parents need to take real sense of ownership in catechizing their children. And I think we need, Todd, good apologetic programs where young people can grasp the concept of a worldview and how we go about testing worldviews and why we believe Christianity to be true. Christianity works. It works in my life. Christianity is powerful in transforming people's lives. But really, it works because it is true. And I think we need to really focus on those types of things and discharge our responsibility as parents, as pastors, as people in the pew in communicating these truths. Because apparently, I mean, if 68% of evangelicals think there may be an alternative path, something, you know, there's a loose wheel on the wagon, and we've got to tighten that up.
20 years from now, maybe I'm still sitting behind this microphone, or maybe you're still doing what you're doing, Ken, and we talk about a Newsweek article on the spirituality in America 20 years from now. How will the numbers have changed, do you think? What do you think we'll be reading about then?
You know, Todd, I find it very interesting that there is in the scientific circles today lots of questions about evolution. Questions meaning critical questions, like is this really a mechanism that it can explain life on Earth and the complexity of life? Todd, I think that even if our major institutions in the West grow to depart from a Darwinian mindset, I still think that the turn will likely be to, again, a more spiritual outlook. It will not necessarily be a turn to a biblical component. I think that given the nature of human beings, in our heart of hearts, we feel that spiritual impulse. We feel that moral impulse. God has written his law in our hearts. We were made in God's image. Undoubtedly, we feel a sense that there must be a maker that made us the way we are. Yet our fallen condition without the spectacles of Scripture, without explicit special revelation, it is very easy to become confused in this morass of religious truth claims. So I think pluralism in 20 years may still be, it may be a greater challenge than today.
Finally, how is Christianity different from all other religions, both theologically and historically?
Well, let me mention the historical first. I teach courses in world religions, and I think it is fair to say that for most of the religions, their historical connection, their connection to the so-called beginnings of their faith and miracles are not nearly as solidly supported by history as is Christianity. I mean, Christianity is about a Christ who was born under the reign of Caesar Augustus, who was crucified at the hands of a real Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. Christianity has a close affiliation with historical events. In our creed that I recite every week in my church, we mention two people in the creed, Mary, and we mention Pontius Pilate. Jesus was a real man. He died at a real time in history. I don't see that nearly as connected in the other religions. In terms of theology, it really is important what we believe about God. How is Christianity different? It's apparent in our belief in the Trinity. This God is beyond our ability to fully comprehend. He is one what and three who's. While there's one God, he's three persons. Yet that second person became a man in Jesus Christ. And not only did he become a man, but he laid down his life. He appeased the wrath of God by his act of faithfulness on the cross. These are truths that transformed Western civilization. These are truths that are incredibly powerful, and we need to be faithful in living out those truths and communicating to others, and not be afraid or embarrassed that we believe the truth to be found in Jesus Christ.
Ken Samples, thank you for being our guest.
It's my pleasure, Todd.
Ken Samples is founder and president of the Augustine Fellowship Study Center. He's vice president of Theological and Philosophical Apologetics for Reasons to Believe. He's authored the book, Without a Doubt, Answering the 20 Toughest Faith Questions. Now, when you get home from work tonight and you go online, check out Ken's website. Go first to ours, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Click links there on the left-hand side of the homepage, and you'll find a direct link to Ken Samples and the Augustine Fellowship Study Center, issuesetc.org. I'm looking at this survey. It says, in answer to the question, can a good person who doesn't share your religious beliefs attain salvation or go to heaven? We've got evangelical Protestants. Nothing is under 60%. Christians across the board, 60% plus, saying, sure, there's another way. Sure, there's another truth. Jesus says, I am not a way, a truth, a life. I am the way, the truth, the life. That's what they're teaching men to preach. As unpopular it may turn out to be, at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Does it comport with the spirit of the age? Not a bit. But it does comport with the Spirit of God as He speaks in His holy word. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. To find out more about it, call them 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or find out more by going to our website, issuesetc.org. They're on our homepage as well, issuesetc.org. When we come back, the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc., we'll spend it with David Martosko, Director of Research for the Center for Consumer Freedom. What are we going to be talking about? Well, we're going to be talking about the theology of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. You may have seen the bumper stickers calling Jesus a vegan. We'll find out what's behind all that when we come back.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues Etc.
One Nation Under God. In God we trust. God bless America. Is the God of American civil religion the God of Orthodox Christianity? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for August is titled The Anonymous God, The Church Confronts Civil Religion and American Society. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can learn more about The Anonymous God on our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. regular guests David Adams, Ken Sherb, Al Schmidt, Ron Feuerhahn, Cameron McKenzie, and Mark Sell have all contributed chapters to this book. The Anonymous God costs $16.99 plus shipping and handling. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for August, titled The Anonymous God, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org for The Anonymous God.
Genesis and Science and a Russian's Conversion.
Answers with Ken Ham, an editor and contributor to Creation Magazine. Well, Ken, how did science lead a Russian soldier to receive Christ as his Savior?
This is a remarkable story, Mark. We told about it in our magazine, Creation. A Russian soldier was studying to become an engineer to build guidance systems for ballistic missiles. Now, during his second year of college, he was taking courses in biology and physics and found that they contradicted each other. According to what he was taught in physics about the two laws of thermodynamics, the evolutionary ideas he was learning in biology just didn't work. So he came to the conclusion that evolution must be wrong and there had to be some type of intelligence behind biology. Well, then he studied various religions to find the answer, but they all had mistakes and inconsistencies within them that totally destroyed their credibility. Then he opened a Bible and read the first statement in Genesis. He was amazed, because it started with a scientific fact, in the beginning. He knew that all scientists agreed that there was a beginning. It took him a full month to read Genesis chapter 1, and then he analyzed every bit of it with his science training. 6 months later, he gave himself over to Jesus Christ.
More and more scientists are beginning to realize that massive flooding has occurred around the world. To receive a great witnessing tool that looks at the reality of Noah's flood, get a copy of Ken Ham's new booklet when you go to our website, answersradio.com. Answersradio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. On talk shows, politicians are frequently the topic of rude jokes. In movies, political officials are often selfish and corrupt. Such portrayals of politicians can mislead our children to think that everyone in government is corrupt or stupid. It is important that our children are not misled by these messages. The Bible tells us that government is a blessing from God. Politics is an honorable profession, and there are many fine people working in our political system. Teach your children not to be misled by the many negative portrayals of politicians in the media. God loves us so much, He sent Jesus into the world to die for us. He has also blessed us with many good political servants who seek to do His will. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Here's a happy AM850 KFUO salute to our day sponsors on this Thursday, August 25th, 2005, Roger and Joanne Knollhoff. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to AM850 KFUO in celebration of their 42nd wedding anniversary. Once again, we say thank you to Roger and Joanne Knollhoff of Carlisle, Illinois, today's AM850 KFUO day sponsors, and best wishes for a very happy anniversary.
Welcome back for the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. The subject for the last 25 minutes, the theology of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. You might not think of this organization, this animal rights organization, in terms of a theology, but make no mistake, there is one at work, and it's becoming more apparent, I think, as time goes by. You see the bumper stickers, you see the billboards, perhaps even occasionally a print ad. Oh, they're all along the same kind of lines. The ones that have become so popular nowadays feature Jesus, a vegan. What's behind it all? We'll find out here in the last 25 minutes. David Martosko is our guest. He's director of research at the Center for Consumer Freedom. They've published a new booklet titled Holy Cows, How PETA Twists Religion to Push Animal Rights. David, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the air.
First of all, is PETA right when we see the billboards or the bumper stickers or the contentions websites that say Jesus was a vegan? He didn't eat meat. He wouldn't eat meat. Are they right?
Absolutely not. If you believe anything close to biblical literalism, you'd have to concede that Jesus at a minimum ate fish. And I think it makes every bit of sense to suggest that since he was an observant Jew while he was alive, that he would have had to at a minimum eat lamb at the Passover Seder. So, when Jesus was resurrected bodily from the dead, he appeared to his disciples in the upper room, and in order to demonstrate that he was bodily resurrected, he asked them for something to eat. They gave him fish, and he ate it. Case closed. Jesus was not a vegetarian. He was a fisherman. And I think PETA should be ashamed of itself for promoting this idea that Christ was a vegetarian in order to suggest their whole theological thesis, which is that you have to be a vegetarian if you're going to be a good Christian.
So they also seem to be very adept at setting up a kind of a false choice. Either you go with Jesus and eat only vegetables, perhaps even the whole boar way of going vegan, or not only a bad Christian, but you're in favor of harming, mistreating, and being cruel to animals of every stripe. Is that necessarily a dichotomy we can live with?
No, of course not. And that's really what PETA does in general, not just in religious circles. They set up this dichotomy that says we are for the ethical treatment of animals, and if you don't go vegan, you must not be for the ethical treatment of animals. I mean, it's ridiculous. Most people, you know, understand that eating meat does not make you a terrible person. They understand that wearing a wool suit or a silk tie or taking your children to the circus or the zoo does not make you a horrible ogre. But in PETA's world, this is the case, that they really believe, and they are true believers. They believe very fervently that the world should evolve toward what they call total animal liberation. And that means you don't get to choose whether to eat meat, that if you feed your child a glass of milk, that makes you a child abuser, that, you know, you should not be able to wear a worsted wool suit. I guess PETA wants the return of a polyester leisure suit. It means no circuses, zoos, aquariums, rodeos. And it also, by the way, means no meaningful medical research to cure AIDS or cancer. Because, of course, all of the major medical advances in the last 100 years have come about, at least in part, through animal testing. And PETA wants to do away with that. PETA's president said a couple of years back, and I quote her, she said, even if animal testing resulted in a cure for AIDS, we would be against it. Now, this is a horribly misanthropic viewpoint, and I think it's you know, borders on cruelty to humans. And I don't think it is in line with what Christ would be doing today.
What is behind all the contentions? First of all, let's deal with the whole animal rights idea, and then let's take it to the issue of what's behind their quote-unquote theological assertions. But what's behind the animal rights idea that seems to pervade everything PETA is all about?
Well, you really have to just take it at face value. PETA believes, and I think they're twisted and crazy, but PETA believes that the rights of animals are the next great, you know, moral social justice crusade. After the rights of African Americans, the rights of women, you know, we've gotten rid of slavery, women have the vote, and now what's left? Well, we have to have rights for animals. PETA says it strives to raise animals up to the level of humans. You know, they claim that a rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy, that there's really no rational basis for believing there's a difference between those. Now, I disagree, of course, and I think that PETA has proven time and time again that all it ever succeeds in doing is lowering humans to the level of animals. Last year, PETA toured the world with an exhibit called The Holocaust on Your Plate. Did you hear about this one?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I mean, they brought these huge posters all around the world that juxtaposed images from the Nazi Holocaust, you know, concentration camp victims, with images of farm animals. And they were trying to make the point that, you know, animals were at least as valuable as these concentration camp victims, but what they wound up doing was offending an awful lot of Jewish folks who said, this is ridiculous. I'm worth much more than a cow or a chicken. You know, you can't compare me to a pig. All they wound up doing was lowering humans to the level of animals, and they're doing it again this summer. They've got a touring exhibit that compares farm animals to lynched African Americans and to black slaves. And the NAACP came out and said, you know, are you crazy? Do you really believe that black men aren't worth any more than pigs and chickens? And this is the pattern. You know, PETA tries its best to suggest that we ought to be treating animals better, but what they really do is they push for this animal liberation, the extreme viewpoint. There are plenty of worthwhile animal charities out there that are worth supporting that really go out of their way to try to treat animals more kindly. PETA is not one of them. You know, PETA wants this revolution in animal rights, not animal welfare, this total animal liberation ethic.
I remember just a couple of weeks ago we talked with Wesley Smith, who writes for National Review Online, and he had written some stuff about PETA on the occasion of PETA actually exterminating, very interesting, you know, taking charge of, I think it was stray dogs and cats, and trying to save them from medical research, but in the course of doing this, actually exterminating them on purpose. And he said, what's PETA doing killing animals? That was his article for National Review Online, I believe.
Yeah, and he's right, by the way. We've actually got a whole website. We were the ones who broke this story. We did some research and pulled some public records from the state of Virginia and found that PETA had indeed exterminated over 12,000 animals at its headquarters. And now, of course, you know, within the last month and a half or so, two PETA employees are now facing a total of 62 felony animal cruelty charges in North Carolina. These two apparently were driving around picking up puppies and kittens from shelters and from veterinarians, claiming that they were going to adopt them out to loving homes. Instead, within an hour, they would kill these animals in the back of a PETA-owned van and then dump the bodies into a trash dumpster behind a grocery store. And so this is, you know, it's really getting people to wake up and saying, is PETA really what we thought it was? You know, can they be doing this? And if PETA is really, you know, I have to say, if PETA is really in the business of trying to claim that there's no difference between humans and animals, and this is how they treat animals, you know, what does that say about how they treat humans?
What did they, is there any rationale, any defense for what they did in that instance that they have forwarded yet?
PETA basically says that, hey, you know, these were animals who were going to die anyway. We basically stroked their fur and sang kumbaya while we administered the lethal injections. I don't buy that because, you know, of the 31 animals they found in North Carolina, of 31 bodies, I should say, six of them were puppies and one was a kitten. These were eminently adoptable animals, animals that you could easily have been adopted out if PETA chose to put in the effort and the money to do it. You know, we accept as a society that we're going to have animal shelters that are overcrowded and that it's unfortunate. Sometimes animals have to be euthanized because there's an overpopulation problem. But we accept that, I think, because we know that animal shelters are so underfunded and they really don't have the resources to handle them all. PETA is not underfunded. Guess how much money PETA raised last year?
I couldn't even imagine. Where is it?
$29 million. Just last year alone.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, for that kind of dough, they literally could care for every unwanted animal in Virginia and North Carolina. Give them food, shelter, you know, three square meals a day, a TiVo, a car and a driver, and a PlayStation. I mean, really take good care of them. But instead, they choose to spend their money on these other campaigns, the ones that offend Jews and African Americans, campaigns that try to do away with the very medical research that's someday going to cure cancer, and campaigns that are increasingly becoming offensive to America's religious majority. There are campaigns that are targeting tenets of the Christian faith, twisting scripture, and misrepresenting Jesus Christ. And this is what they do with their money.
Well, you know, after we talked with Wesley about that, and I'm almost positive that after this conversation with you, I heard from people who were kind of the hangers-on on the edge of the whole PETA movement. And they were very sincerely concerned about animal welfare. They were not asserting animal rights. I don't think any of them were. But They heard criticism of PETA as, then you must be in favor of the slaughterhouses, the unfit conditions in meatpacking plants. You must be in favor of all that. It sounds like PETA's managed to make its case, even with people who probably should know better.
Well, I think eventually there's going to come a day when people recognize that if you want to put your donations into an organization that's going to work for animal welfare, you should keep that money as far away from PETA as possible. You know, PETA does not do a lot of things that actually deal with flesh and blood animals. And as we've shown at the PETAKillsAnimals.com website, you know, close to 85% of the actual animals they come in contact with, they kill. So this is not an animal welfare group. It's a political animal rights group that's trying to remake society in its own image. You know, if you want to give money to an animal charity, and I'm all in favor of animal welfare, give it to your local animal shelter. Better yet, adopt a pet. But don't send your money to PETA, because that money is going to wind up, if you're a religious person, it's going to wind up targeting you and your faith eventually.
Talk a bit, if you would, David, about how in particular PETA has mocked religion and in particular made use, you know, it's clever, but it's very shockingly clever, made use of religious symbols, imagery, even the image of Christ himself for sure. Their own ends.
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to mention we've just the occasion of my talking about this is we've just released a new report. It's called Holy Cows, How PETA Twists Religion to Push Animal Rights, and it's available for free to the public. You can download it at consumerfreedom.com. And in that, you'll find information about how PETA has, for instance, just this year, during Holy Week, they staged a very tasteless mock crucifixion. And one PETA activist, you know, sort of crucified another, but the crucified activist was wearing a pig mask. And their point was that, you know, animals die all the time and no one complains about it, and that somehow animals ought to be equated to Christ. And if you think that's a stretch, consider that PETA has run billboards during the Easter season featuring a picture of a pig and the message, "He died for your sins." Now, there's only one person that died for my sins, and it's not a pig. let's be honest about this. And this, you know, preachers and mainstream religious leaders all throughout the South were up in arms about this and said, oh my goodness, this is sacrilegious, this is terrible. You know, PETA has used the image of Jesus Christ in 7 different billboard campaigns that we're aware of, and even announced on its website once that it was enlisting Jesus Christ as its spokesperson. You know, who else could get away with this?
I'm looking at a picture here in the report that you just talked about a moment ago, Holy Cows, speaking of cows, of a cow in papal garb, dressed like the Pope, and apparently they have their own Pope-mobile, the cow Pope, that they display at various protests and venues around the world. But one thing that I find most shocking here is that this papal cow that they have, this statue, holds a staff that is, in fact, a crucifix, but on the crucifix, not Christ.
It's a cow.
But a cow.
Yeah. This is, and they don't just take this around the country to random places. They parade this up and down the street in front of Catholic churches on Sunday. And they paraded this up and down the street in front of Catholic churches when the Pope was visiting. They're not just trying to raise awareness about some perceived wrong that's being done to animals. They're trying to shock the religious majority of Americans into some sort of consonance with their point of view. Now, I don't think it's working. I think it's angering a lot of people. But I don't see any reason to believe that PETA is going to stop it either. And they're not just going after Christians, by the way. You know, I mentioned the Holocaust on Your Plate campaign. They literally ripped off images from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum for that campaign. And practically every major Jewish cultural organization in North America condemned them for it. They're going after Muslims. They're buying ads on internet search engines telling Muslims that the meat that they buy is not clean, it's not halal if it says it's halal. They're opposing the entire institution of kosher slaughter, telling Jews that, you know, there is no such thing as kosher slaughter. And certainly, you know, their most, shocking and in-your-face campaigns have been surrounding Christianity. And this whole Jesus was a vegetarian nonsense is a great example. There is no proof for it, but they say it anyway. They say it because they're hoping there will be some people out there who won't do their homework scripturally and will say, oh, goodness, if Jesus was a vegetarian, I should be too. And what PETA really wants is a vegetarian United States, and they're quite serious about it. They're very well-funded, and there is very little that they won't do to get it.
How do you respond to the person who says, well, you just hit the nail on the head a moment ago, and that is the goal here is not really any kind of serious dialogue or points to be made. The goal here is to shock, and what they're doing here is just simply trying to demonstrate the shocking nature of how animals are treated by shocking those, like you and me, into noticing it by using images of Jesus or the Pope or putting a cow on a cross.
Well, you know, there's something to be said about that, but you have to recognize that a fellow named Bruce Friedrich, who is PETA's chief vegetarian campaign director, he's third in command at PETA. He's in charge of all their vegan education campaigns and all these shock campaigns. He told an animal rights convention a couple years ago that, seeing how Americans are, majority of Americans are religious, that it was ridiculous for PETA to believe it would achieve their goal of animal liberation all across the United States without getting support from religious progressives and conservatives. Now, PETA is very shrewd. They're a very smart group of people. They recognize that in an age where, two-thirds of Americans or more identify themselves as Christians and go to church, that, without the support of that demographic, they're going nowhere. And so they've started to tailor their messages to attract the attention of religious folks. And they've been very aggressive, because that's what they do. They've actually started picketing churches. They even sued a church this year in Kentucky, a church that tried to get a restraining order because their congregation didn't want to be harassed on Sunday morning. They're very aggressive, but they're hoping that they'll be, that the people in churches will be just as gullible as the Americans who have supported them so far. And I think that's where they've miscalculated. But again, I don't see any reason to believe that they're going to stop anytime soon.
David Martosko is our guest. He's director of research at the Center for Consumer Freedom. They published a new booklet titled Holy Cows, How PETA Twists Religion to Push Animal Rights. We're talking about the theology of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. If you'd like to join the conversation, we've got 10 minutes left. 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. This is Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk about the legacy of violence. You already described the violence to animals that PETA does kind of behind closed doors, but talk about the legacy of violence when it comes to protest or various expressions of protest involving
sure.
PETA.
The same gentleman I mentioned a moment ago, Bruce Friedrich, the guy who runs all of PETA's vegetarian action campaigns, he has personally advocated in public the use of arson and bombs in order to terrify people into shutting down their businesses that sell meat or shutting down their laboratories that do research using animals. He said, and I quote him, he said that it will be a great thing if all the fast food outlets, the slaughterhouses, their laboratories, and the banks that fund them exploded tomorrow, and hallelujah to the people who are willing to do it. This is a guy using religious language to promote arson. And this same gentleman, by the way, has a website devoted to himself where he claims to be PETA's best example of Christian mercy. So when the cameras are rolling, he's out there talking about how Christ would be merciful to animals and so we all should be vegetarians. When the cameras are off, he's telling people, and again, I quote him, that blowing stuff up and smashing windows is a great way to bring about animal liberation. There's a curious, you know, split here. PETA's got two faces, and it's not just in regard to its religion campaigns. You know, PETA is publicly out there saying, oh, you just shouldn't wear fur, you should be kind to animals. But privately, it's always advocated the same exact kind of bomb throwing and arsons that some terrorist organizations have used. And by that, I'm referring to the Animal Liberation Front and the Earth Liberation Front. These are groups that the FBI now says are America's most serious domestic terrorism threat. You're worse than abortion clinic bombers and the militia movements and the white supremacists all rolled into one. These folks are setting hundreds of arsons on a yearly basis, blowing stuff up, making death threats on a regular basis. And PETA, by the way, has given them money. Have you heard of the Earth Liberation Front?
I've heard about it just a little bit. I think most people probably heard about it when they talk about ELF, right?
Sure. Well, that's what it is, the
yeah.
ELF. This is a group that, anonymous activists who put on black masks at night and go and, torch buildings, the homes that are being constructed. They set fires to SUV lots. Basically they use fire as a symbol of protest against what they think is an environmental harm. This is a terrorist group. PETA wrote them a check. If you look at PETA's tax returns, as we have, they're public documents, you can see a check written by PETA to the North American Earth Liberation Front. You know, if we were talking about any other terrorist group, PETA would have lost its tax-exempt status years ago. This is an organization that uniformly endorses the use of violence to reach its goals. And then for it to turn around and with the other cheek say, oh, we're advocating compassion and kind Christianity for the animals is laughable. We just think it's time Americans recognize that PETA has two faces.
Now, I think my daughter was a vegetarian for about 3 years. She decided she was going to do this when she was much younger, and we thought this will last about a week, and it ended up lasting about 3 years. And then kind of as quickly as it came and went, and she said, I'll go back to eating hamburgers and whatnot. And we were happy to have her as a vegetarian.
Oh, sure.
Because she was right at that age when we were thinking, boy, she's actually developing some really good eating habits here eating.
Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with being a vegetarian.
But I'm wondering how much to that kind of vegetarian of goodwill. For her, it was just a matter of she didn't feel like eating meat anymore. She was really worried.
There was a peer group thing involved, too.
Yeah, there was something involved there as well. But how much does PETA try to appeal to that vegetarian of goodwill, the person who says, I just don't feel comfortable eating meat, or maybe I feel more healthy being a vegetarian?
They do some of that, too. And by the way, there is nothing wrong with being a vegetarian. You want to be a vegetarian, a libertarian, whatever. It's a free country. God bless you. Go do your thing. What we resent is PETA using deception, scare tactics, and frankly, using blasphemy and using sacrilege as a tool to try to intimidate people into making the choice that they want us to make. PETA thinks we all ought to be vegetarians. Fine. They're entitled to think that. They're entitled to stand on the street corner and shout that as much as they want. I think they ought to, though, leave churches and synagogues and mosques out of their little vegan cultural holy war. They ought to just leave that out and set it aside and say, we're not going to go there. The fact that they've chosen to go there is an indication that, all bets are off. These folks are going to do anything it takes to turn us into a vegetarian America, whether we want it or not. And there are a lot of people who don't want to be vegetarians. And I think PETA ought to recognize that that's the way things are and leave the rest of us alone.
When I go home tonight, David, I'll be greeted by my dog, the cat, if he can find his way up the stairs. He's 18 or 19 years old. He'll probably say hello. We got a couple fish in there. We've got a hermit crab hanging around someplace. And this is just the latest in the long line of the kind of pet menagerie in the Wilkin household. What would PETA make of my pets and what we do with our pets at home?
PETA would patronize you and would say it's really unfortunate that you have to keep those pets as property. They would say, you know, certainly we shouldn't enslave these animals. And PETA is totally against seeing eye dogs and the training and use of them and the training and use of police dogs. PETA would say, that's it. This generation of pets is all we're entitled to have. When these pets die, don't replace them. You know, that's it. We should be spaying and neutering everything that walks on four legs so that they can't possibly reproduce because we're not entitled to treat them as slaves. Now, I wholeheartedly disagree. And I think PETA has shown that it's willing to do just about anything to thin out the herd of domestic animals. They're killing them by the thousands. This is not a warm and fuzzy animal welfare group. I keep saying this. This is a sort of a vicious animal rights group that will stop at nothing. And you know, I'm sure there are some members of PETA who have pets. There are probably a lot of people who give money to PETA that have pets. There are probably 100,000 Americans who go to church and give PETA money. And I think those two things ought to be mutually exclusive.
You know, if it's slavery, it's the other way around in our household because I pay for the food. I feed the dog. I open the door for the dog.
The dog takes you for a walk.
Exactly. I mean, if anyone's enslaving anyone, the dog's enslaving me, although I still love her.
Of course you do. I mean, human beings have a natural bond with animals, and we have a natural sort of symbiosis with animals. We rely on animals for so many things in this culture, for companionship, for entertainment. Yes, for food, absolutely. For research cues to teach us how to make drugs that are less toxic to humans. I mean, I would rather, if I had Parkinson's disease or cancer, I would rather have a drug where they tested it on an animal first instead of making me the first test subject. We rely on animals for so many things, and PETA says no. They want to drive a wedge between humans and animals that, regardless of the cost, regardless of the comfort. And I think that's ridiculous. And I don't think Jesus would have approved of that either, because remember, he gave us dominion over all the animals.
ConsumerFreedom.com is the website address for the Center for Consumer Freedom based in Washington, D.C. ConsumerFreedom.com. This new booklet, you can find it at their website. It is free. Holy Cows, How PETA Twists Religion to Push Animal Rights. David Matusko, thank you very much for being our guest.
It's my great pleasure. Have a wonderful day, everybody.
You too. David is Director of Research at Consumer Freedom, the Center for Consumer Freedom. Well, here's a question that I want you to think about tonight. Give it some thought, some serious thought, and then call me tomorrow on the program. We didn't get to some of this Nina Shea audio. Tomorrow we're going to play some of it for you. Nina says the Iraqi Constitution, as it is proposed, is highly problematic for women's rights, for, and this is what interests me, religious freedom. So here's the question I want you to think about tonight. Give me a call tomorrow. If Iraq becomes an Islamic state where the Quran, where Islam becomes the basis for legislation, for the laws that are passed and the way those laws are judged, was the war in Iraq wrong? Think about that tonight. Give me a call tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll be back live. Not usually on Friday are we live, but we will be giving you a live edition of Issues Etc. tomorrow. That question for you, give me a call. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.